Shoreline, Tampa, Florida, 1944. On February 6th, the Admirable Class Minesweeper USS Density is launched. On June 15th, under the command of Lieutenant Commander Robert Forrester, Jr., Density enters service, first as a training ship at San Diego, before sailing for Pearl Harbor and war duties in the Pacific. March 19th, 1945, Density leaves Ulithi to sweep mines ahead of the invasion of Okinawa on April 1st. April 6th, a full-scale kamikaze attack is made on the U.S. fleet, and the Density, unscathed, goes to the assistance of the badly damaged USS Rodman, picking up 16 survivors and towing her to Karamoretto. April 22nd, the bitter fighting continues. USS Density is under fire once more, sustaining only minor damage before rescuing three survivors from USS Isherwood. April 27th, Density shoots down an enemy aircraft. Valuable intelligence material, including a secret code book and photographs, are found on a body recovered from the plane. May 4th, Density sinks an enemy suicide boat off Okinawa before sailing to join the American Third Fleet strikes against Japan. August 15th, 1945, and the war is over. But our gallant ship remains on occupation duty until November 20th, when she sails home to join the reserve fleet at Orange, Texas. Her fighting days are over, but not before receiving three battle stars for her wartime service. March 3rd, 1947. Just over 3 years since her launch, the USS Density is finally decommissioned. But who knows what future now lies ahead for this brave little ship and the brave men who sailed with her, risking their lives for freedom and democracy. All America salutes you, Density, and long may you sail.
Greetings, this is Cardboard Chews, Keith Skews. No one in the United States Navy could possibly have imagined on that March day in 1947 that 17 years later, the USS Density would take on a very different but equally colorful role as the motor vessel Galaxy, home of Britain's most successful and profitable offshore radio station, wonderful Radio London. Big L.
You're hearing things. Wonderful Radio London.
This is the story of Radio London, a brief but fascinating chapter in the history of British sound broadcasting. Big L's origins, however, like the ship from which she broadcast, were American, the brainchild of Don Pearson, a fast-moving Texan entrepreneur with business interests in banking, real estate, and automobiles, and the mayor of the small town of Eastland, situated to the west of Dallas. In June 1964, Pearson was reading a newspaper article about Radio Caroline.
One Sunday, I was sitting here in the sitting room, and I was reading the Dallas paper, and in the paper it said something about this guy, Ronan O'Reilly, in Ireland. He's going to put together a radio station on board ship. And I kind of mulled about it all afternoon. That evening, late, well, I decided I was going to England. A few times I'd turned the radio on in Europe to British stations, I had been bored up the wall. And the more I thought about it, and I thought the free enterprise radio system in the United States and what it brought to the people over here, that it also would bring pleasure to people in England. And this offered a vehicle, if it were possible to do, to both bring the pleasure to England, plus make a capitalist profit. We returned to Texas. I called a few people that I knew that I felt might be interested in investing in a venture of this nature, and found there was interest. And the first question they always asked was, if this is such a good idea, why wasn't it done before? And that was a question that really and truly I couldn't answer.
The first person Don Pearson spoke to was his friend and business associate, Tom Danaher, owner of a Volkswagen automobile agency and small airport in Wichita Falls.
Don said, "Tom, you know, this looks like a great idea that this Ronan O'Reilly guy has." And he said, "With your experience in the Navy, having been on ships and flying off aircraft carriers and so forth, do you think it would be practical for us to even think about something like this?" And I said, "Well, Don, this is so far out, I don't know. I don't know whether a ship would be available or how much it would cost or whatever." So Don said, "Well, you know, I think it's good enough that we should actually look into it." And I said, "Well, Don, if you want to, I'll sure go along with you here, because I think it looks like it had good possibilities also." And Don said, "Well, I'll try to get some guys together, you know, in my little circle of the world." He was the chairman of the board of the Abilene National Bank. And, of course, he knew the guys that he brought in down there.
Pearson and Danaher arranged a meeting with oil man Jack McLaughlin and, most significantly, Mal McIlwain of the McIlwain Cadillac Company in Abilene. McIlwain had useful contacts at the J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency, who gave encouraging reports about the commercial impact of Radio Caroline. The men agreed that their own station could be a most profitable enterprise, and they decided to press ahead. Pearson would coordinate the project, McIlwain would organize sales, and McLaughlin would look after the legal and tax affairs. Danaher would have special responsibility for the ship.
And then I brought in guys from Wichita Falls here. They were rich men's sons, principally. Mike Cadane and Pierce Langford and David Kimball and Bud Dillard, all big oil men's sons. So that's how the different partnerships came up.
With a total of 17 shareholders on board, the Texans put up $1.5 million, the money going into a Bahamian trust fund based in Freeport. The company would finance the project and control investor and employee accounts under the Bahamian zero-rated tax system. Another company, Panavess Incorporated of Panama, would purchase the ship and subsequently charter the vessel to the Bahamian company. An independent British company would be established to sell commercial airtime, and all revenue would be transferred to the Bahamian account. Mal McIlwain knew of a very suitable candidate to front the British sales operation. 37-year-old Philip Birch, an Englishman, had worked for J. Walter Thompson in America before transferring to their London office in 1960.
And then I continued with JWT for another 3 years. Maybe four, and then left JWT to start Radio London. It came about because a friend of mine in the States had read about Caroline and phoned me and said, "What a great idea," and it got started that way.
Philip Birch's first task was to secure suitable office accommodation in London. On the 1st of September 1964, he moved into 17 Curzon Street, a plush former showroom for a fashion house in the heart of Mayfair. Meanwhile, back in Texas, Don Pearson and Tom Danaher had been hard at work searching for a ship. Pearson remembers the problems they encountered on the way.
First thing I found out was that there's no used ship lot. All the ships that would be suitable were always in service. And I covered the Western Hemisphere and parts of Europe searching for a suitable ship, and I finally found one in Miami, Florida. And I bought it.
The ship was the 780-ton former USS minesweeper Density. Sold in 1955 to a Greek company, she was renamed Manula and saw service as a cargo ship. However, by 1964, the ship was in Miami and up for sale by an order of court, the owners having failed to pay harbor duties. Pearson paid $80,000, and in August she moved to Dade Dry Dock, ready for conversion into a radio ship. Tom Danaher.
It was up at Merrill Stevens' yacht basin up the... It's a little skinny river. It's a wonder that ship even would get in there. We had to have it pumped out first because it was about half full of water, and to get it down to Day Dry Dock. And then, of course, that's where the work started. this was the most available ship, and that's why we bought it. Of course, as you can tell by looking at it, it was kind of a junk heap. But and it had seen a lot of action in the war. But it turned out to serve the purpose real well. Of course, all the equipment in there, nearly all had to be not completely overhauled, but at least refurbished to get it going. And we did have a lot of mechanical problems, particularly there at first, but as time went on, we got it where we took it over there. Of course, RCA, to me, has always been the name in transmitters. I had a friend here in town that was a radio transmitter engineer, and I got him to tell me which one to get. And he said, you cannot beat an RCA. So then I started, I think RCA was in New Jersey, if I remember. And I contacted them, and they told me that there would be a so much waiting time to get one of their transmitters from New Jersey, but that they had the identical transmitters that were made in Italy that they could sell us for so many $1,000 less. But it was Italian, but they could get it immediately. So that's how we wound up, and I made a contract with them and bought it. I went to their office in Dallas, I remember, and that's where we made the deal.
As well as the 50-kilowatt Ampliphase transmitter, Danaher's $97,000 deal with RCA included the studio equipment. The bulk of this consisted of an RCA 4-channel consulate mixer, 3 RCA tape cartridge machines, 2 16-inch Gates turntables, and Scully tape recorders. The 212-foot radio mast, manufactured by Union Metals of Ohio, would be installed by a team of marine architects.
I was worried, I can remember. One of the main worries that I'd wake up in the middle of the night worrying about was the when that thing would lean over, there would be a down thrust on to the substructure there. And so I thought it would probably, you know, crush the deck structure on down. So I built a structure that went below the antenna, straight down to the keel of the ship. And that worked out because the antenna never shifted a 16th of an inch. And it went through some pretty tough weather.
Things were now progressing well. But what would the new station sound like? Moreover, what would it be called? The answer came from Dallas.
Cabin conditions, barometric pressure falling 29.91. The wind north 12 miles an hour, humidity 71%. KLIF temperature 44 degrees. Now the 8 o'clock priority one headline. A restriction has been placed on all military personnel at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio because of an outbreak of spinal meningitis. This is Dick Mock.
This edition of KLIF News has been brought to you by Pearl Beer.
The powerful KLIF 1190 radio in Dallas had been founded by Gordon McClendon in 1947. Adopting a slick top 40 format following the arrival of rock and roll, KLIF, or Cliff, was now the top-rated station in Texas, and Don Pearson was keen to use it as a blueprint for his own station.
At that point in time, well, the top station that I was aware of was KLIF in Dallas. And I simply was going to copy their format, since it was so terrifically successful. And that'd be simply a top 40 format of the most popular music, and brief news and brief weather. I talked to Gordon McClendon because I'd found out in the meantime that he had, in years past, had put together a similar radio ship off the coast of Scandinavia, I believe it was Sweden. And I'd never met Gordon McClendon, but he was very helpful in the suggestions that he gave me.
In fact, so taken was Don Pearson with the whole concept of Cliff that he was determined to call the new station KLIF London. Dallas was known as Big D, and so London could become Big L.
Indeed, at one point, Pearson simply wanted to record the output of Cliff and replay the tapes over the ship's transmitter to give the British audience a taste of American pop radio. KLIF Dallas jingles would be edited out and replaced by local identifications for KLIF London using exactly the same music. The idea was dropped when Philip Birch pointed out its likely lack of appeal to British advertisers. He also voiced concern about the Cliff name, explaining that in British eyes, Dallas had a rather tarnished image following the assassination of President Kennedy the previous November. Birch had suggested the name Radio Galaxy, but for a while, with no firm decision coming from Texas, he adopted the temporary names of Radio X, Radio Big, and even Radio Unlimited.
Yes, the working title was Radio Unlimited, and then we all put in, the various backers, including myself, putting ideas as to what it should be. I chose Galaxy, somebody else chose London. We all then sort of decided that we'd call the station London and we called the ship Galaxy.
Philip Birch's British sales company was subsequently registered as Radlon Sales Limited and opened for business on the 21st of September 1964. By now, Birch had persuaded experienced newspaper advertising man Alan Keane to join him and help sell Radio London to potential advertisers well ahead of its launch.
I was at that time working at Fleetway Publications, which became part of the Daily Mirror group of newspapers. And I got back to my office one afternoon at about 4 o'clock and had a message to ring a Philip Birch, whom I'd never heard of before at all. And I returned the call, and he said, "Oh, I was wondering whether we could meet." And I said, "Yes, absolutely. When?" And I thought, JWT. But he said, "No, it's outside the agency. I'd like to meet you at the Hilton Hotel. I've got a room there." So, playing hard to get, I said, "Well, I can't make it for the next couple of days," but eventually went round one evening, and this little guy answered opened the door with red braces on and a cigar, an American. I said, "I'm Alan Keane, here to meet Philip Birch." He said, "Oh, come on in, have a drink," and we sat down, and I thought, "Where's Philip?" So I said, he said, what do you do? And I said, "Well, I sell advertising. What do you do?" And he said, "Well, I'm a radio engineer." And I thought, what's radio engineering got to do with advertising? And we talked for a few moments, and then Philip Birch walked into the door and introduced himself, and we started talking. And the outcome of that conversation, that meeting, was he explained to me that it was his intention to start a pirate radio station, similar but better to Radio Caroline, which, as you know, was already well underway. I joined Philip and at that time became the sales director. Now, a short while after, I suppose within a couple of months, maybe 6 or 7 weeks or so, Dennis Maitland, he at that time was with Associated Newspapers. Like myself, his background was that of selling space. And he came in. And so we were at that time four of us.
I went round to 17 Curzon Street and into the offices with all of the mirrors and things around. And there was a desk with a bucket alongside it as the ashtray and Phil Birch behind it. And Phil Birch then approached me and said, "Well, will you and won't you?" And thereafter, we were invited down to his house in Kent, as my wife and I, and to meet some of the Americans. And we came to an agreement that was what we were going to do.
Getting involved with advertisers, it was funny, really, looking back. Because, of course, there was no copyright protection on the name, Radio London. And so we had a rate card, not a printed rate card, it was a photocopy, a plain A4, typewritten, which Margaret did, and it was headed Radio X. And I used to go to agencies and I would say to the contacts that I had, "This could be the most exciting opportunity for your clients. It's called Radio X, can't give you the name, because there was no law to protect ourselves." And it was a good name, in our view.
Yes, it was organized very much like American radio stations organized their rate cards. We called the best time, peak time, we called it AAA, because A isn't good enough, so we made it AAA time. And we sorted in packages that I think were typically packages of 50 spots, that sort of thing.
In Texas, Don Pearson started hunting for professional radio people who could operate Radio London in the style of KLIF Dallas live from the ship.
I called several people and in a radio and commercial radio business in this country, and one mentioned Ben Tony as being very capable and qualified. And I called Ben Tony and advised him of the opportunity, and he immediately accepted. Being a Texan and being familiar with KLIF, he was able to almost identically create the same sound on Radio London that KLIF was producing in this country.
He said, I would like for you to go over to England and operate this radio station. And I said, well, can you give me a couple of weeks, so I can kind of sort things out in my mind whether I want to do this or not. He said, but I can't give you that much time. I said, well, how much time can you give me? And he said, well, I'll call you back tomorrow. So he called me back the next day, and I had a conference with the manager of the station there, and he said, well, I think this is a great opportunity for you, because we had known about Radio Caroline previous to me going over there. All of the people in broadcasting knew about this, and they thought it would be a super thing to do, you know. And then I flew down to Miami for a while, for several days, to look the ship over, and I remember when I first saw the ship, I thought, man, are they going to put people on this? But I'll never forget the first time I saw Tom Danaher. Tom came crawling out of the engine room looking like a grease monkey, and I said, this guy is one of the owners of this thing, you know? He looked awful. And I had some information on him, you know, about him being having a big car dealership and owning a part of an airport in Wichita Falls and all of that. And I had visions of this guy coming out in a business suit. He looked terrible. He had grease all over him, all over his face.
Ben Tony returned to Dallas and spent several weeks studying and recording the output of KLIF and consulting with Gordon McClendon and his staff. Gradually, the proposed format and on-air sound of Radio London began to emerge, although McClendon had already suggested one important aspect of the sound, that of station identification jingles, to Don Pearson.
He told me who to see, and it was a company called PAMS, and a Mr. Bill Meeks. And so I simply went to PAMS, Mr. Bill Meeks, there in Dallas, and told him that I wanted to order the same jingle packages that they'd sold KLIF that were so very successful.
PAMS stood for Promotions, Advertising, and Merchandising Services. Gordon McClendon had played a part in setting up PAMS with KLIF musician Bill Meeks in 1951. Employing only the best writers, musicians and singers, PAMS jingles were elaborately arranged and engineered, and by the early 1960s they dominated the American pop radio airwaves.
Rock solid is our country's foundation.
Progress is the byword of the year.
Leadership is the key to the future.
The more status quo, it's the new frontier.
Hi there, this is Gene Oliver and the PAMS gang. We've put together a special presentation of our new Series 17 to show you.
We've been looking out for your interest.
Hope you will lend an ear.
Curtains going up.
It's smooth sailing with the highly successful sound of WWDC 1260.
It's smooth sailing with the highly successful sound of wonderful Radio London.
Alan Keane recalls trying to explain the concept of identification jingles to puzzled advertisers.
I remember going to advertisers and saying this was going to be the most exciting new form of radio, and we would have musical passages called jingles by which listeners would know the name of the station, because the vocal parts of the songs or the musical passages would contain the identity name of the station itself. We decided within the jingle package to accept the idea, the American idea, that to call ourselves wonderful was not totally taboo. And of course at that time it was very un-British. You didn't really bang the drum in your own favour as much. You didn't really tell the whole world how wonderful you were.
Wonderful!
Meanwhile, Philip Birch had taken expert advice on available frequencies to enable the broadcasting crystals to be ordered. 1125 kHz was selected, later changed to 1133 kHz, but announced as 266 meters medium wave. In Miami, work on the Galaxy was nearing completion, although her conversion to a radio ship had been interrupted when two of the former owners attempted to steal the vessel in appalling weather conditions. Don Pearson.
There were two gentlemen that were the previous owners from Greece that decided, probably they were under the influence, to take the ship and sail to Greece one night. But the night they chose to leave Miami was the night they had the hurricane. And in the middle of the night, I got a call from the Coast Guard in Miami that our ship had been washed up on the intercoastal canal exit into the Atlantic. And I immediately flew down there, and the ship was not damaged. And we hired tugs to at high tide to pull it back off and bring it back into the dock area where we were outfitting it.
The two seamen escaped before any action could be taken against them, but there followed a visit from the FBI, who had been told that Pearson was planning to broadcast propaganda into Cuba on behalf of the Cuban exiles. They were satisfied with Pearson's explanation that the Galaxy's destination was, in fact, England. American bureaucracy caused further delays, as Ben Tony remembers.
We had problems, for one thing, with the building that was to house the 50,000-watt transmitter. They hadn't checked with the Bureau of Ships, and they didn't have the right gauge metal to build this thing. So they went ahead and built it anyway. And then the people came back to inspect it, and they said, well, this is the wrong gauge metal. Don Pearson, somehow or the other, was in close contact with the Johnsons. And Lyndon Johnson was, at that time, President of the United States. So, some way or the other, Don used his political influence, and they sent a memo from the president's office telling them to let that ship out.
On the 22nd of October 1964, MV Galaxy, now registered in Honduras and under the command of Captain Coo Walters, finally left Miami for an anchorage point in the Thames estuary within sight of Shivering Sands Tower. Galaxy had scheduled ports of call at San Juan, Puerto Rico, and the Portuguese island of Madeira in order to pick up provisions and facilitate some more work on the transmitter. On board was Ben Tony, an experienced seaman, having spent 3.5 years in the United States Navy.
It took us 17 or 19 days to go from Miami to Madeira, and along the way, the engines must have stopped on us a good 5 or 6 times. And it was really scary out there. Finally, when we got to Madeira, Tom Danaher flew over along with Bill Carr, who was supposed to be getting the transmitter into operation.
Lack of facilities in Madeira diverted the Galaxy to Lisbon, where Bill Carr was at last able to attend to the transmitter and Tom Danaher repair the ship's engines. Ben Tony flew with Don Pearson from Madeira to London, Tony's main task now being the recruitment of DJs and the scheduling of programs. They were later joined by Danaher. Despite the delays, Philip Birch issued a press release, and the newspapers eagerly reported the impending arrival of this latest and largest addition to the Pop Pirate Fleet. The Galaxy finally arrived in the Thames estuary on the 19th of November 1964, but Don Pearson's party, now staying in London's Hilton Hotel, were not happy about the ship's location. Tom Danaher.
Right off of Sheerness, because I had to go there to see if I could make an anchorage for the ship. And, of course, we had been told that that would be a safe anchorage and that it would be a legal anchorage. But then later we found out that it wasn't, so we couldn't go on the air. So that's when we moved from there up by Clacton.
The Galaxy's new location was 3.5 miles off Frinton, in sight of Radio Caroline and close to the Gunfleet sandbar. But the confusion over the ship's position contributed to a growing tension between Don Pearson and Philip Birch.
Then after that, Don and Philip were at each other, you know, just about everything. The only thing I think they ever agreed on was that I should stay there as program director and manager of the station. But I was walking a tightrope because of Philip and Don.
It was clear that Pearson and Birch had very different ideas as to how things should be done, and there followed a number of disagreements over policy. As a result, the key investment team found itself split down the middle, with Mal McElwain and Jack McLaughlin on the side of Birch and Tom Danaher on the side of Pearson.
The big problem came between Mal McElwain and his bunch, and then he mustered all of the guys that were just putting money into it. And they came down on Don because, of course, Mel was from Abilene, and he had been brought into the project by Don. And he got everybody to come in on top of Don as though all these problems were Don's. And, of course, I stood up for Don, so then that made them come in on top of me as though, you know, I was wrong along with Don.
At the end of November 1964, a meeting was called, and in the interest of the station, it was decided to replace Don Pearson as project leader with Jack McLaughlin, who had to date invested the largest sum of money.
Don and I had done the work on the whole thing. These other guys had taken and written checks. I mean, signing their names was the amount of work they had done, because as more money had to keep coming up, they would get a bigger share of the project, and of course Don and I would dilute our interest the more money they would put in it. And of course most of these guys with the rich daddies and all that had an unlimited supply. And Phil was on their side, so I think Phil came out real good.
It was agreed that Philip Birch would, more or less, have a free hand in putting Radio London on the air, although Ben Tony, whose appointment by Pearson was also questioned, would remain as program director.
Don was kind of kicked out of the company, so to speak. Mal McElwain and Jack McLaughlin, who were the main investors, pretty well made their own terms. You know, they said, well, if you don't want to accept what we're offering, well, you know, forget it. We'll send you back home. Well, I didn't want to go back home. I wanted to continue with Radio London. I wanted to put this thing on the air. So I was kind of pushed out of the way by the owners. And Philip Birch kind of fell in with the owners, and there was a little bit of tension between Philip and myself, but not too much.
Shortly after Don Pearson faded into the background, the Financial Times quoted a Radio London spokesman as saying the pop radio market was oversubscribed and that the new station would adopt a format more akin to the BBC Home Service, interspersed with music of a serious manner. This sudden change of direction seemed all the more likely with the appearance of a British-made jingle package. Clearly, the proposed change of format would be at odds with Ben Tony's programming aims, and the decision was soon taken to revert to the Top 40 format employed by Gordon McClendon's KLIF in Dallas.
Gordon McClendon started up the Top 40 type format some years before Radio London, and it spread all throughout the United States. Every one of the Top 40 stations were top in their market, mainly because they were playing basically the music that people wanted to hear.
The music consisted of the 40 most popular records of the day, but Radio London would compile its own Fabulous 40 and include records it believed would shortly become hits, thus creating the impression of being ahead of the national chart. A fast turnaround of records would add to the illusion and hold the listener's attention, because records considered past their sell-by date would be replaced by something up-and-coming or new.
Wonderful Radio London. Have you heard?
A program wheel, or hot clock, ensured regular and even rotation of the Fabulous 40, with the top 10 receiving the most airplay. And to this were added DJ's Records of the Week, known as Climbers, Revived 45s, and the occasional album track. Each disc jockey would host a three-hour show.
I had to get some disc jockeys together, and that proved to be a very difficult thing, too. Pete Brady, Tony Windsor, had some prior experience with commercial broadcasting, but the rest of them had no experience at all, and they were... Most of them had worked with the BBC Foreign Service, and they were sort of typical BBC-type personalities, and I really had to whip them into shape, you know.
Tony adopted a policy of making the DJs use false names, primarily for their own protection in the event of government legislation. Australian Tony Windsor, real name Tony Withers, had worked at 2SM in Sydney before coming to Britain, where he joined Alan Crawford's Radio Atlanta. Windsor's experience made him the ideal candidate to head the DJ team aboard ship and knock some of the newer DJs into shape. His air shift would be from 3 to 6 in the afternoon.
I joined Radio London on the late October 64. I went down to some little place and got off the train. It took us over in beautiful calm waters, and we climbed on to Radio London.
Canadian Pete Brady, real name Peter Ince, was a top 40 DJ from the Caribbean, given Radio London's prestigious breakfast show between 6 and 9.
I don't know where they got my name from, but I had an odd phone call from Radio London, a certain Ben Tony, who said he heard that I had done radio. Would I like to come and talk to him? Which I did. Next thing I knew, I was drifting out to the North Sea on a fishing boat to have a look at this floating thing. Came back ashore and I was asked if I wanted the job, and I said, yeah, why not?
One by one, the others arrived. Paul Kazarin, whose background included work for the African service of the BBC, Forces Broadcasting in Cyprus, and a short spell as presenter of Late Night Lineup on the new BBC Two television, was renamed Paul Kay. And, as well as presenting an evening show between 6 and 9, was given special responsibility for Radio London's news.
My earliest memory was my first encounter with the then programme controller, a Texan, big, tall, sort of caricature of a Texan called Ben Tony. And he asked me in the London office in Curzon Street what I thought about format radio. It's a type of broadcasting I'd never done before, and I was interested to see the sort of psychology behind it and how it worked. And then he said, well, what do you think is going to permit any of our listeners to detune, to go to another station? And I said, well, 1:30 every hour, the light program, remember it was a light and home and third in those days, the light program runs a newscast, and particularly when the test match is on, you're going to lose listeners unless you do a newscast too. And he asked me what news experience I'd had, and I pointed out that I'd been trained by the Department of Information in Kenya, and he said, right, we've gotten ourselves a news director. And that's how the news service was born. It was as casual as that. At that stage, Caroline didn't operate a news service at all. I, in fact, started the first one, and I make no bones about it. I'm jolly proud of it.
John Dean would be known as Earl Richmond. His experience included Forces Broadcasting in Trieste and Cyprus and freelance work for Southern Television. His Radio London show would air between 9 and 12 midday. He would also be responsible for onboard administration. Neil Spence, now Dave Dennis or the Double D, came from Radio Atlanta and Radio Invicta, the latter broadcasting from Red Sands Tower in the Thames Estuary. He would head up lunchtimes between 12 and 3.
The final recruit for the launch was Morris Cole, a 19-year-old newcomer from Liverpool, whose hobbies included tape recording and listening to the radio.
I've always been a huge fan of radio. I used to listen to what was called the Home Service in those days. I used to listen to right up until the end, because that's when the announcer used to get intimate. When he thought the Director General wasn't listening, because he was tucked up in bed, he'd sort of ad-lib and say, well, I can see the gas lamps flickering in Portland Place. It's time to wrap up for the night. And he'd have a little chat with the listener. And I always used to stay up for that because it sounded quite cosy. So I made a tape up and sent it to a programme called Midweek. And they sent me a telegram back saying, darling, come immediately. It's wonderful. I did the interview, and I said, wow, you've got carpets that go right to the edge. I want to work here. They said, well, we haven't got any jobs at the moment because there's Pete Murray and David Jacobs, and that's all we need, really.
BBC producer Wilfred Dayath played the tape to agent Chris Pears, who was sufficiently impressed to pass it over to Ben Tony.
And I had never heard of a disc jockey having a manager. That was just something that was totally foreign to me. And Chris brought me this tape. And I thought, well, that sounds pretty good, you know, young lad, 19 years old from Liverpool. I thought, well, if I could put him out there, he ought to be able to learn rather quickly. And he listened to all of these tapes that I'd brought from Dallas. And, man, it was no time before this guy was really getting it on. He was a really top-notch disc jockey in no time.
Initially employed to work swing shifts, Morris Cole now became Kenny Everett, taking his surname from the actor Edward Everett Horton.
So the next day, there I was in Frinton Railway Station with my bag full of hankies and Y-fronts and toothpaste off on board this tub. And I remember the lights of Frinton going from side to side and me leaning over the edge thinking, I'd give my legs to be in Frinton.
With his on-air team assembled and aboard, Ben Tony made them listen to the rapid-fire and jargon-filled delivery of KLIF's top DJs. He soon realized the folly of asking them to just copy their American counterparts and instead, with the help of Tony Windsor, taught them to adapt the best of the American techniques to their own distinctive personalities. This included using an artificial reverberation unit.
We had an echo chamber. The disc jockeys used it some, and that did enhance the voice a bit, and also it caused the sound to come through better on the radios when they used a little reverb. And it made us have a sort of a unique sound as opposed to the other stations that sounded kind of flat and dull.
Although fitted out with up-to-date American broadcast equipment, not much thought had been given to the soundproofing or appearance of the studio situated towards the stern of the Galaxy. Tony Windsor remembers his first impressions.
Now, we had a table. I had one table in this vast space, but I had no timber, and I was wondering how I was going to get a sound. We had various meetings as the boys came on, the Double D, Earl Richmond, Kenny Everett. And the idea occurred to me that it had to be blankets. So we got all our blankets and we put them round the little table, you see. Well, this is absolutely marvellous, except that no one could have a kip or no one could go to sleep while we were on the air. But we got a marvellous sound.
Pete Brady.
There were Gates turntables, Grey Arms, RCA cart machines. There was a table on each side. There was a little console in front with a VU meter. A microphone on a lazy arm.
By the 16th of December 1964, everything was finally set up and more or less ready to go.
We knew that we had to test the signal. And one of the funniest things of all time, really, I shall never forget it. We knew the frequency was going to be 266. So on the particular morning prior to the commencement of broadcasting, we gathered around at 11:05 around this wireless, as that was called, and we tuned into 266. And then at 11 o'clock on the dot, we suddenly heard this high-pitched tone, this signal, and we knew that that was us. There was no voice at all. And we knew that we could receive it in the West End of London.
Exactly 24 hours later, at 11 o'clock, the 17th of December, Paul Kay made the first historic announcement, followed by a haunting piece of music recorded by Pams of Dallas and called
the Sonno Waltz.
Wonderful Big L.
From that moment, the Sonno Waltz became Radio London's unofficial signature tune, and the affection for it from Radio London's DJs was soon apparent when they rechristened it Big Lil. Test transmissions proper started on the 18th of December, continuing until the 22nd of December. Pete Brady again.
They tried pushing the power up, and there was a lot of trouble, or there were a lot of problems, I should say, with getting the system to work. It was an RCA transmitter, maximum 50,000 watts. I think initially we couldn't even get it to push over 25 because it kept arcing over these. We had these glass resistors that came out of the top, and the cable went from there off to the mast, and it kept arcing back to the boat, which was a problem.
This transmission from Radio London, and even before regular programs begin, the news of the world is here, wishing a successful future to this new and powerful station.
The problem with the transmitter meant that Radio London would launch on a reduced power of 17 kilowatts, and official transmissions began at 6 a.m. on Wednesday the 23rd of December 1964.
It starts Wednesday on Wonderful Radio London.
Oh, yeah, Cliff Richard having a ball, as he is called. I could fall in love with you and turn the panto. Aladdin and his wonderful little old lamp at 3 minutes and a half past 6 o'clock. You're listening to the Pete Brady Show, and a great big wonderful good morning to you here from Radio London.
Philip Birch recalls listening to Radio London's first official broadcasts.
It was quite fantastic, yes. The station sounded very good. We weren't on full power. I forget the... We had 50 kilowatts, and I think at the time we started, we were putting out 17 kilowatts, and but that was still a very good signal. It took us a while to get the equipment to put out the full 50 kilowatts, a while being a few months, but even at 17, it was a marvelous signal, and it was very exciting.
Wonderful Big L, Radio London. Wonderful Big L.
Wonderful Radio London.
The Dutch Weismuller Company was now contracted to crew the ship and operate the tender service. Dutch Captain Bill Bunniger took command of the Galaxy and immediately brought order to the ship and gained respect from all on board, although a shortage of water was making life very difficult for everyone. Dennis Maitland explains.
In fact, actually, we'd had the clear water had been sabotaged at that stage, and salt water had been put into it. Kenny was a very bright and clever young man, but he would say things on air which were not necessarily expected or even wanted by us. And he actually went up on air and was saying, well, he was so short of water that, you know, he was slitting his wrists and drinking blood or whatever.
And a nice little seventh there from the guitar reminds me to remind you that you're tuned to Wonderful Radio London with the clock reading 20 and one half minutes past 6 o'clock. And, oh, come in, do. And the clock check reminds me to remind you that yet again we are going to go on the air extra hours tonight, not stopping at 9 o'clock when I take a rest, but going right through till 3 o'clock in the morning. That's because today is Christmas Eve and tomorrow is Christmas Day.
Within a few days of Radio London opening, a seventh disc jockey was recruited. David Wish, British by birth, had worked in Canadian radio at CFUN Vancouver and CJV Port Albany.
A friend of mine called Bill Street wrote to me in Canada and said, it's all happening over here. We got Beatles, we got Pirate Radio, we got Stones, we got The Who, and, you know, you should come over. So it took me 2 weeks to get over here. I knew Radio London had just started, and I went to their office and banged on the door, tape in hand, my audition tape in hand, and played it to the program director.
Ben Tony had, by coincidence, met Wish in Dallas some years before and felt his radio experience would prove useful in assisting Tony Windsor's training of newcomers like Kenny Everett. with the new surname of Cash, after singer Johnny Cash, Dave remembers his first journey to the galaxy.
Just basically puking over the side of the tender, I think. As soon as I went out to the ship, it was very rough, because it was the day after Boxing Day, December 64, and it was rough, very rough. And just getting aboard was a full-time job.
In view of the bad weather, and to keep spirits high aboard ship as 1965 approached, on New Year's Eve, Philip Birch and Dennis Maitland flew by helicopter to drop whiskey and cigarettes on the deck of the Galaxy. Texan engineers Bill Carr and Art Nabeau, who had originally been employed by Tom Danaher to install Radio London's powerful broadcasting equipment, returned home shortly after the Galaxy arrived off the Essex coast. In the meantime, Dutch and Belgian engineers were put aboard to maintain the equipment and continue working on the transmitter, which was still giving cause for concern. The station also advertised over the air for engineers, and in January 1965, Russell Tollefield joined. The technical setbacks did not prevent a press conference being held at the Mayfair Hotel in London to formally announce Big L's arrival. Early research indicated that around 1 million people had already made the switch to 266. Philip Birch.
Quite massive response. Within days, we were getting a lot of mail, and within weeks, we were getting it by the sackful. It caused a very good reaction. We felt we had no enemies in the world, that people just loved Radio London and loved the whole idea. I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, I felt that I knew a lot about advertising, but I did not realize it would go quite as well as it did. I thought it would go well, but it went incredibly well right from the beginning, and the advertisers loved us, and we got a lot of good support from the advertising industry.
Alan Keane.
I think that it became a lot easier for our own team at Radio London because we were already long established. We were known to be trustworthy, I suppose, reputation. We had been selling space for national newspapers for some considerable time. So because of that, by going into Young and Rubicon and Hobson Bates as they then existed, and JWT, we were known. So for us, yes, it was a lot easier, possibly, than for the other stations, whom I gather had a lot of new people in selling their own station. So it wasn't as difficult as we initially might have supposed.
Meanwhile, Godfrey Morrow had joined the sales team and another £100,000 worth of advertising contracts were being finalised. A large account, estimated to be worth around £50,000, came from the Worldwide Church of God, based in California, and producers of The World Tomorrow, a half-hour religious talk programme hosted by church leader Garner Ted Armstrong. Initially broadcast over Radio London for one night a week, by March 1965, the programme could be heard every night.
The World Tomorrow, with Garner Ted Armstrong. Send your letters to BCM Ambassador, London WC1.
It is a fact that the amount of money that it brought in took care of our basic costs, so it gave us a nice feeling of security that the rent would be paid.
Disc jockey number 8 joined Radio London on the 1st of February. Gerald Clements, alias Duncan Johnson, was a Canadian with broadcasting experience on radio stations in Saskatchewan and Alberta before moving to Bermuda and then to England in 1963.
In November, I read about Radio London in the Daily Mail. I thought, no, I must find out about this. And I went on to Ben Tony. So I went to see him. He said, have you got a tape? I said, well, only an old tape of some commercials I made in Bermuda. There's only three commercials on, very similar. And he said, that'll do for me. I gave him the tape and heard no more from him for months. Then I was working on a movie set. Stuck me in a little room. He said, could you wait here? I'd like you to meet the boss. A few minutes later, he came in and he said, I'd like you to meet Philip Birch. And Philip Birch said, shook my hand and said, welcome aboard. He said, I'm glad to see a nice-looking, clean-cut chap like yourself is coming to join us because there's some funny-looking people around here at the time.
That's the Beatles, and they're the furthest thing from being down. They're number one, the Fabulous 40.
Paul singing, I'm Down. You're out with the modern sound of Radio 266.
Biggest sound around, Big L.
There was much interest in Radio London's news service, and many rumours abounded as to its source. At the beginning of March, the station's press officer, Mike Stone, assured curious journalists that the news was not stolen, but in truth, Radio London was rewriting BBC bulletins, although attempts had been made to secure deals with Reuters, Associated Press and UPI. Philip Birch.
We wanted to do a news service, and I went along to the various news services to work out an arrangement that we bought a news service, Reuters and Associated Press and so on. They all thought it was a great idea, and then came back to me one by one and said, we're just not allowed to sell you a news service because we are selling to the BBC and we will be getting objections from the post office, which of course controlled the telephone, the line service. So we couldn't have a line out to the ship at any time. We didn't have a line to the ship. And so they just said... in the nicest way, but they said no, that we couldn't have a new service. And so we developed a scheme where we listened to other radio stations. This was all done by Paul Kay. And we put together a newscast, and we did it on the half hour because most news programs were going out on the hour. This gave us sort of 30 minutes, or gave Paul 30 minutes to rewrite the news and to put out our own news service.
Now, Radio London News tells you more, says it better.
Dateline, Big L Newsroom. Content. Radio London covers international as well as home news. All items of interest, from a plane disaster in the Far East to a golden eagle in Regent's Park, from a trade sanction on Rhodesia to the price of croissant bread rolls in Soho, is ammunition for our news service. Timing. On the half of every hour from 6:30 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. There's also a cast of headlines at 8 in the morning and a review of the day's happenings at 11 at night. Quantity. 17 newscasts are broadcast each and every day. This amounts to a daily total of more than 10,000 words. The weather. The latest weather forecasts are given every 30 minutes. Yet another part of the service that keeps Radio London listeners fully informed. More news at the bottom of the hour. This is Paul Kay reporting.
A national opinion poll survey commissioned in February 1965 showed that south of a line between the Wash and the River Severn, Radio London had amassed an audience of just over 2 million. Car stickers were now circulating and the Big L Fan Club was established. The first advertisement for the club appearing in Rivali magazine, quoting a membership fee of 5 shillings. With the start of the motor club racing season in March, driver Keith St. John, a regular at Brands Hatch Circuit in Kent, approached Radio London for sponsorship. Radio Caroline were already involved in motor racing, and Philip Birch was keen to get in on the act. Radio London's association with motor racing would continue throughout the station's life.
A lovely song, sung with a great deal of feeling and compassion by Peter and Gordon. And it's about to be released in this country in about 10 days' time. It's a Radio London climber at the moment, and it's called True Love Ways.
Hello, my name's Twinkle. I just dropped in on Radio London to thank them for helping make my first record, Terry, the success it was. I hope I have the same success with my second record, Golden Light.
The 20th of March 1965 saw Radio London at last switch to its full power of 50 kilowatts, and interest in the station was now coming from several unexpected directions. Harold Shampen, managing director of Film Music Limited, set up with Philip Birch a music publishing company called Pall Mall Music. Shampen's idea was to publish songs featured on the flip side of singles by largely unknown artists that Radio London would include in its playlist, hoping that A-side airplay would bring about national chart success. With equal royalty payments being made to the publishers of both A and B sides, Pall Mall Music would thus see a good financial return.
Wonderful Radio London, biggest sound around, Big L.
By the start of April 1965, Kenny Everett was sounding like a seasoned pro, and without doubt his remarkable talent and unique disc jockey style was contributing to Radio London's rapidly growing audience. Ben Tony had assigned Dave Cash to help Everett with the finer points of broadcasting technique, and the two DJs had become good friends. Although their sense of humour differed, there was enough common ground for the two of them to explore the idea of presenting an off-the-wall double show, as Dave Cash remembers.
We were given tapes by our program director, Ben Tony, and they were of KLIF in Dallas, in Texas, and he said, this is what I want you guys to sound like. You know, this is how tight they are. You want time, temperature, you want this. Get your personality over in here. Listen to this and learn. And there were two guys that did breakfast at Cliff called Charlie and Harrigan, Charlie Brown and Irving Harrigan. And one was a straight guy and one was a loony. And Kenny and I looked at each other and said, we could do that. And we did.
Welcome back to music on the Charlie and Harrigan Show.
We'll have golden goodies and classy classics for you all day today. At 7 minutes past 8 a.m., Charlie and Harrigan wish a big happy birthday to John L. Lewis. Today, he's 86 years old.
Oh, yeah. John L. Lewis, man, long known for the miners, you know, and everything.
Yeah, we gave him a call a while ago, incidentally, to see how he was feeling. And he says he only has, yeah, the guy with the bushy eyebrows, mm-hmm. He says he only has one wish, and if he could do it all over, just one wish, he'd like, one thing he'd like to change.
What did he say?
He said, I'd love to be able to walk into a bar and order a beer without some clown saying, I'm sorry, sir, we don't serve minors.
Charlie and Harrigan in Cliffland. Whoopee!
Ben Tody was very familiar with the antics of Charlie and Harrigan.
Charlie was a guy that I employed in Abilene years before. His name was actually Danny McCurdy. During that time on Cliff, Ron Chapman, alias Irving Harrigan, had several Charlie Browns. But at the time that we formed Radio London, Danny McCurdy was the Charlie Brown. But they listened to these tapes of Harrigan and Charlie Brown, and they formed their Kenny and Cash show. After a while, it got as good as Harrigan and Brown, you know.
The Kenny and Cash Show launched between 5 and 6 p.m. on the 6th of April, 1965, and within a few weeks became essential radio listening, gaining an almost goon show-like status. Indeed, so immediate was its success that the two were asked to write a weekly Kenny and Cash column for Music Echo, and continue their double act at live appearances on shore.
And that's the Beatles off their album Beatles for Sale and Rock and Roll Music.
How about hey there, boys.
Who is this?
I think it's Myra Krelge.
Oh, no, not again.
I'm Myra Krelge, and I bring the coffee and the tea.
Oh, that's very nice. We've got
our boys.
Oh, thank you. Oh, that's kind of nice.
Boy, this is some coffee.
It's tea. Huh? I've never been so insulted in all my life.
Oh, boy. Can't win them all, friend.
Well, if you're feeling down, come on and get happy. Woo! With wonderful Radio London.
On the 20th of April, 1965... Dave Dennis and Pete Brady's routine tender trip back to the galaxy after a week's shore leave suddenly became anything but routine.
And I can remember sitting on this tender. We looked up and we saw this parachute coming, just floating down. It wafted out of the sky. We never, ever saw the aircraft that was related to it. The person, the pilot, as it turned out to be, was unconscious. And he just sort of splashed down in the water quite some way away from us. And we chugged over to him. I seem to remember jumping in. Dave Dennis was involved, and we pulled him out. And I mean, we did